It is June 17th, 2014, and we must have the
Volume up.
volume up. Yeah, okay, good. At least it didn't squeal at us. And the interview is taking place at my apartment in Thunder Bay, Ontario, and I will have our interviewee for today introduce himself and tell us a little bit about his connection to the grain trade.
Tom Hamilton, I worked in the grain trade both as an employee of the various companies and the union from 1978 till 2011. 34 years.
And so young, so you started out really early.
No, actually, I started about 5 years later than a lot of the other
Oh,
guys.
really?
Yeah. A
So,
lot of them started at 18, I started at 23.
okay, so let's, were you born in Thunder Bay?
No, I'm not from Thunder Bay.
So where did you grow up?
Various places, but Madawaska,
Okay, no
White
place with
River.
elevators.
No, I had no interest in elevators at all
No.
of any at any time.
So, what was your first experience with grain elevators then? How did you
Oh, I knew people who worked down there, but it was just happened to be I was an electrical apprentice and found out that the fellow I was working for had never registered me as an apprentice, so there was a number of it was a bit of wasted time in my career. So basically, he was paying me 40% of the journeyman rate and telling me I was an apprentice when he should have been paying me like a full laborer's rate or something. So anyway, I quit and just went down to the elevators to get some steady money, ended up there for 34 years.
So, how did you end up in Thunder Bay then?
We moved up from White River for high school. There was no high school unless you traveled 50 or 60 miles, so you couldn't do any extracurricular activities.
So, did you have any experiences with the elevators as a kid, as a high school kid?
Nope, never toured them. I did play hockey for I guess it'd be United Grain Growers, it was McCabe's, and so they hired me on for one day so my name would be on the payroll. And then after I was there for 3 or 4 hours, they sent me away, and then I was legally able to play for their hockey team.
Was this a usual procedure for?
Oh, they did with a couple of us who came out of hockey, were fairly good hockey players, and they would sign us up and make us eligible, and then we appeared on a payroll list, but were never paid anything, and it was just a technicality.
So the league was pretty competitive then.
Oh yeah, it was a good, very good league. Yeah, the Elevator Hockey League. Still around in a different form.
Who is it?
Different name.
So who were some of the people playing at the time you started?
Jack Malcolm, Danny Edmonds, Joe Colic, Chuck King, Walter Pressinger. Treyer, I think. Chesterman, Antoniak, all kinds of very good players.
We had one person that we interviewed talk about the hockey team, which I guess started long before you
Oh,
started
yeah.
working. And he was commenting on how he quit the league because people like you were being brought in, and it was being competitive, and he'd been injured because,
Oh, it was a very rough, very competitive league. It was lots of fun to play in, but a lot of us had come from that type of hockey and, played up to the junior level and stuff like that. So it was a very good league. A lot of guys went on to play with the Twins and things like that afterwards. So it was an intermediate, for some of us, it was an intermediate from junior to something else. And then there was pros that came back and things like that. But yeah, there were lots of good players, and there was lots of that stuff you were talking about where you had, I guess, fake players because I guess it'd be 1973, 5 years before I ever started work at the elevators, and I was listed as an employee who could play.
Was there one team better than the other, or was it
Oh, Pool
highly
7 was
competitive?
excellent. Grain Growers was excellent. Pool 1 had a very good team. Saspool 4 had a very good team. else. A lot of times it was us and Pool 7 who were, and then we always went to tournaments, excellent tournaments. They had good teams in Red Rock and Nipigon, and people like Alex Dampier and Pierre Felce and people like that. And we'd pick up players then from around the league. Lots of fun.
Yeah. How long did you play for the team, for the
league? Until I moved to Calgary in 1976. And then I played again when I came back. But okay. Just short period of time.
So you were around a lot of elevator workers, which made you somewhat familiar with the kind of work that was done?
No. We didn't even speak about the elevators. We just played hockey. That's what we did. And talked about that stuff. And in fact, I can't remember any conversation other than that day when I was at the elevator pretending to be hired, that where the elevators even came up.
Hmm. Time then that you decided to go and work in an elevator in order to make some money, was it difficult for you to choose where to go and apply?
No, I had friends who worked at United Grain Growers, both at McCabe's and at the one on the waterfront, and the father of one of my hockey playing partners was Bob Antoniak, who was the superintendent at United Grain Growers. And Ray Cousineau, who was another superintendent, at that time I think he might have been a foreman, knew a lot of the people I knew who worked at the plant. So he was actually the guy who hired me. And then Bob Antoniak kept me on. And that was in August 78.
And UGG just had one plant at that time?
No, we had McCabe's and UGGA.
So which one did you work with, when you were hired on, you sort of float between the two?
Float between the two, but my main house was A House.
So describe your first day on the job, do you remember?
First day on the job, they had us training because they'd hired so many people. The thought was that Ray had hired a bunch of people, because if he didn't, then when Antonia came back from holidays, he would hire the people, and Ray wanted his people in there. So we had double crews. So I started on day shift up in the distributing floor, and never happened. You always started on what we called shit gang, was a sweeping crew. So if you were lucky, you were in the car shed. But I started actually inside training on the what we call the spouts and distributing floor.
And how do you think you rated leapfrogging the system?
There was all kinds of people who were leapfrogging the system. There was 20 of us hired, I think, in the same day.
They couldn't all be sweeping.
So it was a good idea to train them. And, of course, in those days, there was a lot more training going on. But when Antonia came back, that all ended. We went back to our proper positions until we had earned our way inside.
So what were your initial impressions of the elevators themselves?
Oh, they were big, confusing. They were very dirty and dusty. And I hadn't worked in dust conditions before, so, it was a hard time getting used to the dust. But after a while, you used it very quickly, unless you were allergic, which I wasn't.
Mm. What were the operations like? Let's go back to when you got demoted back to where you should have started. What were the conditions like? Boxcars were starting to be replaced, or still?
We had one hopper track out of six at A House. The rest of them were all boxcars. So there's three receivers that were boxcars, and then there was an extra track on the far end of the shed that could do full tankers. But yeah, it was all boxcars then. My job there was mainly in the dumpers. So I'd stand inside the dumpers, the door breaker would come down, and I'd be pulling material out as the grain is coming out, making sure it didn't get caught in the grating going down into the hopper. They liked us to wait till the end of the car, but we liked to ride the dumper as it went back and forth while the grain was going, so we could grab the stuff as it was coming rather than climbing down and cleaning it out later.
So Oh, tell me where the dumper, like, describe this dumper operation.
A part of the track was a whole part of the floor and track was separate from the rest of the floor and track, and it was on a big semicircular pivot or gear. And so it would literally tip up to 45 degrees with the boxcar clamped onto it. And depending on what way you were tipped, to the right or to the left, there would be an arm that would come in and direct the flow of the grain out of the car into the grating or the hopper.
And so, where exactly would you be standing?
I'd be standing inside, starting off level. They'd break the car door, the grain would start to come out, they'd let that run down for a while. Then they'd insert the arm in and it would tip, and I would tip with it up to the 45 degrees on one side and 45 degrees on the other side. And you'd usually do about seven tips to get the 40 to 60 tons of grain out of there.
Almost like a teeter-totter.
Yeah, just like a teeter-totter.
So you were in the dumper, not in the car.
I was in the dump. The fellow who's running the dumper actually stayed stable. I was on the, I guess you'd have to say, the axis of the dumper, so that I moved with it, free of the dumper operator. So the car and myself or anyone else who was there moved with the car.
And you said you liked to work as the grain was flowing because then it meant that you didn't have to do so much cleaning out of the car once it was finished.
And less chance of it plugging up.
Yeah.
Because in those days you had all kinds of paper linings and things like that. Wood wasn't too bad, but it was mainly the paper linings and plastic linings that come up and clog it all up, and you'd have to go and clear it out anyway, so.
So what would you use to assist with the flow?
Sometimes you're a poking stick. Generally, we'd go in with our hands and grab the stuff and pull it out. And after something got through, we'd use a long, like a pike pole, 20 feet long or something, go down and stab the debris and bring it up. That was it, mainly handwork.
A lot less, what's the word I'm looking for? Physical than having to shovel with the
And the caves are
cable
still
shovels.
shoveled, but we didn't use the cable shovels at AOS, and they had switched over by that time to the bobcats, electric bobcats. So when I worked, there was no augers or cable shovels that were in use regularly, except for in emergencies at either house. It was all either using a bobcat, and sometimes you had to go in and sweep out stuff, but there was no cable shovels around. They were still around the waterfront, of course, then, just not at our place.
You said that the elevators were big and dusty. I would imagine at that time that was before
Well,
the
McCabe's,
latest
for
round.
example, had no air in the annex, and there was no floor in the annex. It was all open bins. So any grain coming in, it just billowed around in the annex. You couldn't see from me to you, but you couldn't see 3 feet.
Was it, in spite of the conditions, was it a relatively safe place to work, or was it?
No, it wasn't safe, but there was a lot of that came later on. I mean, we struggled for a long time to get the place to be safe. There was a lot of drinking going on. There was a lot of very uncareful work just being done the way we always did it,
So
you
what would
know.
be some of the common injuries that would occur?
Actually, there were very few injuries. For one of your previous interviewees, got crushed on a boxcar. He was on the ladder, and I guess he went in and hit part of the dumper. I believe that's how it happened. You probably remember him describing the accident. Rick Mandrell.
No, that was one of Dr. Epps'
Oh,
interviews.
okay, yeah. And
Yeah.
he got his leg shattered, and every now and then a cable would break. And there was back constant, of course, there was back injuries all the time, and but a lot of injuries weren't reported in those days. You just went on and worked, and cuts and stuff like that. But very few serious injuries. There was actually more murders and suicides than there were serious injuries.
Murders and suicides?
And we had one murder and about five suicides.
What happened with the murder?
The murder. there was an issue with some money being owed, and the person who the money was owed to, who was also one of our employees, came into the elevator and threatened the one fellow. And the next day then went out to the fellow's house and, you know, threatened him again, and the fellow shot him through the door. And he was judged not guilty by reason of self-defense. So
interesting.
Then we had another fellow come in and would never ever have been handled the same way, but he came in carrying a gun into the plant. He had some family troubles. Everyone saw him carry the gun in, not everyone, but management and other employees. But that wasn't necessarily unusual in itself, because we had guns in the plant. We would shoot ducks and geese, and people used to shoot other birds and vermin and things like that. So sometimes we'd have, in midnights, we'd have a duck supper, goose supper, whatever. So the gun itself wasn't unusual, but circumstances around it, this fellow was never one of those people who did that stuff. And then at the end of the day, he took the gun with him. And one of the foremen, who currently still works, saw him as he was coming in for a night shift for him, and he did a double take. And the guy went home and shot himself in front of his family. But we believe the intention was he was going to do something in the plant. And
was he on bad terms with other people?
He was under an awful lot of pressure at work that we didn't know about more about. We didn't know all about it until afterwards. Some people did. It wasn't general knowledge, I think. He was under a lot of pressure from the foreman. He was one of the head guys in the car shed. Production stuff, eh? And then he had other family issues, which we weren't privy to, but it became obvious later, too late.
Yeah. The suicides, not work-related, I would assume, just people...
Work-related in a way that there was a lot of drinking that went on in those days, and we always called it later on, and it came to be known across the waterfront as an enabling situation. So we had some pretty serious alcoholics in the plant. Two of the suicides were probably directly caused by, drinking issues and alcohol issues.
And the fact that
over the years, they were like they
starting
20 years down
to
the road.
Starting to insist that you no longer drink.
It was pretty well cleared up by the end of the 1980s, except for in a couple of plants where you had some committed people. Management people included. So where there were management people involved, there was also more of a likelihood to turn a blind eye to some of the goings on in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Like a management that smokes and enforcing non-smoking?
Yeah, that type of thing.
Was
management
smoking?
That drank, and so they didn't mind if the other people did as well.
So over the time that you were there, your 34 years, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
33 years. The drinking issue really changed around. What do you think
there
happened?
Oh, yeah, big change that we noticed at one of the plants after one of their fellows, after a night, was found floating in a slip. That would have been Sasquatch Pool. Ours... And it started to change when they actually started putting management people on the off shifts. There was never any management people on 4 to 12 or midnights. So you would be pretty well on your own. So the work would get done, but not in the way that the work gets done now. There's much more of an emphasis on efficiency and production. In those days, you had to get certain things done to allow the operation of day shift to continue, like make room on the cleaner deck. For example, so there was, and make sure the machines could run, that cleaned the byproducts. So there was never any dumping or anything on nights. There was on 4 to 12, but not on midnights.
And why would that be? Just a question of.
Well, use that shift to get everything ready for the next two. So if you had extra cleaning to be done, to clear out your shift, cleaning could never keep up with the dumping speed. And in those days, in most plants that I was involved with, McCabe's and egg grain growers, nothing went to the annex until it was cleaned. So you always have shippable product in the annex. There were a few exceptions, but not enough, not much. So everything went to the deck. So if the deck didn't clean fast enough, you had backups on your dumping. And the way they rated everything was, you know, cars per shift. That was how you made your money. And, you know, foremen were rated on that and judged against each other on the basis of that and things like that. So we'd have certain things we'd have to do on nights to make sure that conditions were optimal for dumping the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So that was done. But in the meantime, there was a lot of free time, you know, where you had all kinds of opportunities.
So drinking, given your age, were drugs also an issue?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Not as much as drinking, but I mean, all those things go together, right? And you have the age of the people involved and the habits of the culture, the youth culture. And some even the old guys. We called one of the old guys Goldmine. And he was probably in his... It's hard for us to tell, because the generation before us looks so much older than we did. And when you look at pictures, you can see 45-year-old people look like they're in their high 50s or early 60s. And anyway, some of them, so this guy might have been only in his 40s, and we thought of him as being, you know, close to retirement or even death, you know. But anyway, he somehow got a taste for what used to be called Colombian gold. And that's what I did hear him saying. He had this accent. Where's my Colombian? And someone would provide him with this stuff. But who knows? He was from Europe. And there was a different culture over there. They may have had more access over there. I don't know. Anyway, he was quite happy. He was one of the few older guys who...
So were there pushers on the job?
Oh, yeah. Heck, remember in the inspection office, the head inspector came in one day and there was a fellow there cutting up his... I can't remember if it was both his grass and his cocaine or what, but they have very accurate scales there. So he was able to use the inspector scales, which you're very familiar with, and go and measure it all out and bag it all up. The foreman never saw him doing it, but the inspector certainly didn't appreciate that his equipment was being used.
Anything they could do about it, or they just, again, turned a blind eye?
I don't think he was doing it again. He had been doing it for quite some time. But he may have just stolen a piece of equipment and done it at home from then on. So there was lots of that going on. So.
Was theft a problem?
What could you steal from an elevator? People stole things like welding equipment. I remember going out the door, welding machine, big welder that you had to have on a trailer. Pipe, lots of conduit, grain. We had a whole grain of oats, a whole bin of oats. Not one of the biggest bins, but a medium-sized bin that probably held, I'm forgetting now how many tankers that held. I think it held 4 tankers. And when they went to ship it, it was gone. Well, it was at the very back of the elevator, and they'd opened it. And over the period of time it was there, taken it out the back, there was trucks coming right up to the back of the, you know, Wangro's elevator. I don't know if the bin was full. And the oats all disappeared. You'd see trucks going out steady. And there was people who actually worked on the tracks all the time, and they would have a system going with the dumper operator. So he'd leave a certain amount in, because you could leave up to a dust line. Remember, the government would check the dust line in the cars. So the grain had to be leased down to there. But that meant there was always something left. So then they would try and leave a little extra in the cars, send it down, and these people would bag it all up down on the tracks. And some people made very good money in bagging and selling grain for years and years.
Mm-hmm. We interviewed one fellow who actually, I guess he was on the P&H land area.
Right.
And his family, that was sort of their second business, and it was...
Oh, yeah, lucrative business.
Yeah, and it was, everybody knew it was going on.
Oh, every plant had them. You know, there was no... Every now and then, so there would be some effort made to chase them away. But, I mean, that went on for at least 12 years, my first 12 years at least, That was, part of it. And stripping them, I remember, about the car, the houses that are built with wood from the elevator, and some of those box cars had beautiful hardwood inside them. And it didn't take very long for a good crew to go in and strip all that beautiful wood out of the box cars before the railway had a chance to take them away.
Did any elevator employees moonlight as part of these?
Oh yeah. Like I was telling you, the guy with the one guy had the connection with one of the main people who bagged grain, so he was a dumper operator, so he was able to make sure that he'd leave a certain amount in the cars, eh?
And get a kickback,
Yeah, they had
or
a partnership, probably paid him with cases of beer or something like that.
and but. More interesting is how they could empty a whole bin, and people seeing trucks coming and going. Like who would have overseen that operation?
Well, one example later on, we were changing over McCabe's to handle malting barley one particular season, and we happened to have McCabe's was full of sunflower seeds. And you couldn't have any sunflower seed contamination in malting barley at all, none. And so their idea was to get all the sunflower seeds out completely, nothing on the floor, nothing in the bins. And they, so a number of boats came and we were shipping them. I was on Midnight's, I guess, and one of the last ones, had to be the last one. And there was spills in the basement. There's always spills from the seeds. So we were cleaning that stuff up, and then I think by the next day, or at least by the end of the next day, they had to have all the seeds out, and then they were going to be bringing the barley in, had to be, well, would be inspected by the malting people. They'd come in and make sure it was acceptable before the, and one of the things was the sunflower seeds had to be out. So that night, there were the bags that the trimmers use for making partitions, those bushel bags, and we probably, and along with the trimmers, grain trimmers, and everyone else, I can't remember how many hundred bags, hundreds of bags of sunflower seeds went out. That everything was cleaned up, went out in bags in people's trucks. And in Current River, there was at least three places where bags were stacked, 10 high and four deep, and distributed around to people. Sometimes they were sold at $10 a bag. Stuff I had was just given away to people. But it was, I remember the one foreman looking out the window in the morning, it was light by then, and seeing one truck, fellow's truck going by, and it was just loaded down so with the bags. And we had a foreman on at night with us that time. He was well aware of it and the whole deal. He agreed with all this stuff. And then the foreman on J's shift looked out and he said, "Well, where does he think he's going with that?" And we said, "Well, that's what we're told to do, is clear out all the sunflower seeds, get it out. None in the plant." "I don't know about that," he said. But anyway, it was all, that was the last truck that went out, was that one. It was just laden. See, it's people were driving back and forth all night.
Was anybody ever disciplined for? Did they ever fire
For
people for?
theft, I mean, that culture was changing in the early to mid 80s. And one guy, I remember just before he retired, he still going on figuring, "Well, I've been doing this all my career," and they warned him, don't touch it. And he ended up being suspended for the like 3 months, but they didn't fire him. He was retiring in at the end of the 3 months. And then another guy was taking sand, I think, that the railway had brought in, Bazook's railroaders had brought in to use for some of the repairs that they were doing, so it wasn't our stuff in the first place. And he said he'd asked about taking it, and no doubt he did receive permission from one foreman. But the superintendent saw him doing it, he wasn't hiding it, and they fired him for the theft. And he insisted, he said it wasn't theft, it was given by this foreman. I'm sure that is what happened as well, because that was a standard procedure. And anyway, he ended up not fighting it, and he left. He said, "I can't work in a place like this anyway. Too many idiots." So yeah, those are the only two I know who were in all the years who were actually fired. Usually we'd ask if we wanted something and there was no problem.
Just to go back a bit, you worked at UGGM, so that was the place I understand that had a pot operation on the roof.
Yeah, that was before I got there. There was a fellow in, who was hired the same day as me, and I'm not sure exactly where the operation was. I thought it was a downstairs, but it might have been on the roof, and because I never saw it, we saw the fire when they had to burn it all. They were ordered to. Nobody's ever charged or anything. They just took out all the plants, and they burned all that pot there on the property, and a person who grew it. Or people who grew it were required to do the burning. So there's lots of tears that day.
And a lot of people clustering around to take advantage of the burning.
Yeah, there would have been lots of them, including the foreman.
Yeah. Well, and I would guess, like, that's not something that people wouldn't see. I
What do you
mean,
mean?
it would have been people that working in that elevator would have been well aware of it, all of them.
Oh, it was all well known. Yeah, there was nothing hidden in those days. Very little hidden of anything. The only thing you'd hide is your foreman or your superintendent if they're too drunk to work, so you take them down the tunnels and hide them away, or your co-worker. Those were hidden, but it was well known. We had a superintendent who would go into his office and lock the door. As long as he didn't see it, it wasn't happening. That was his thought on the matter. And that went right through to the 90s. That was his habit.
And so the outsiders, the people from the Canadian Grain Commission, again, blind eye or part of the
Well,
whole.
for things like the seeds and sunflower seeds and McCabe's, there wouldn't have been any of them there that night. And the Grain Commission was just as involved as anyone else. I mean, there was no difference really. We have pictures of the which you might have seen of their inspection table, and their inspection table is entirely covered with bottles of booze. The standard thing to give a Grain Commission employee was booze, bottles of booze, or in some instances cash. But in our experience, it was all booze.
Did you feel that that influenced the behavior of the inspectors at all?
Oh, definitely. There was no arm's length relationship. Not at all.
Would they
The
look the other way as far as
inspection
inspection was
still went
concerned?
on. Oh, they looked the other way, but I mean, sometimes if they turned, they would still turn vessels down and things like that. And I remember one of our earlier superintendents having to fly to Montreal with a Grain Commission guy from here and examine the shipment down there and get it certified. It was certified by the time they came back. Whatever happened, who would know? But the guy here wouldn't certify it. So there was, they still did their job as best as they could, but there was a lot of collusion between the elevators and the commission. I mean, we were putting burning grain on ships at some point, so burning canola, rapeseed we called it then.
How could you?
Pellets were burning. You couldn't see in the basement. We'd stand one side on the other side of the belt. I'd be on one side, another person on the other side, and maybe breaking up the burning chunks so they'd go along, and then every now and then we'd bring a sample up. And I remember they stopped us loading in the one tank because that's where it was going to be, right over the bunker C, I think they called it, some type of oil. And this isn't stuff we bought that was burnt, this is stuff that was burning in the bin.
Why would they do that?
Why would they burn?
Well, I can understand
You
why
had to
they
get rid of it
burn,
somehow. So
but
but normally
how?
what you do is you'd have it, when you're cleaning out a bin like that, you'd have it, and that had happened earlier in 78, where we'd actually diverted it out to the side of the elevator. And this particular time, we were shipping that burning and hot stuff directly onto the vessel. Should never have been going up the lakes, ever,
And why
going up
was
the
it?
lakes. Well, there was lax concerns. I mean, we used boards to keep the belts straight down there in those days. Wooden boards, because belts shift back and forth with loads, so we would jam boards into the belt to keep it straight, so you could ship. Well, it's friction. The
Oh.
belts, the boards would burn.
Okay.
Just like lighting a fire with rubbing sticks together,
who would have like I just can't understand why an operation would allow that to happen, given trying to keep a customer happy.
Well, our main concern was getting the stuff out. Once it was out and on the ship, it wasn't our concern anymore. So they would tell us what to do, and that's what we do, take it out. I can't see someone ordering. There's no ship captain today that would ever put that type of cargo on their vessel. They wouldn't do it for safety reasons. Whether it's gas, flame, whatever, it's already hot. Some of it was burnt right out, fine, because it's not doing anything else. But if the grain is still moist and heated, they don't want any of that in their holds, none. They've got to go across the ocean or wherever they have to go with them.
So, in this instance, it would could you get away with it from a customer perspective because it would have been a small percentage of
A
what was
customer might
into
have
that?
bought that stuff,
Oh, really?
and then they would do pressings of it to get the oil out.
Ah,
If
okay.
it's completely burned out, there's no oil in it. But if it isn't, you still have an ability to get some oil. So lots of times customers bought anything. McCabe's, we had a, Bill Green had a program set up, which we really enjoyed working on because we tried trying to make McCabe's profitable and keep it going. He did this niche marketing, so things that were normally garbage, he'd try and find, or the company try and find markets for, and then we would clean to those specifications. So it made the job very, very interesting because you weren't just running grain through, you were actually creating different products as you went through. And so you had to have trained people and you had to do your job very, very well. It all came out in percentages, it was all checked. And that's where one of the areas where the seniority system would screw up in the way that the companies used it, because they would allow, some companies would allow bumping. In that case, they shouldn't have allowed bumping into that job because that had now become a specific skill job. But the senior guys would bump into it. Then they'd go back to the old way of running, which screwed up all of our splits. So the entire, all the work you'd done for 2 weeks, and this specifically happened a number of times, was ruined by one night of somebody else being in there who didn't know what they were doing.
Now, what do you mean by splits?
Well, you have different, when you're going through a machine, you have different products coming out in different areas in the machine. So we would set the machines up so more of this would come out. You might lose some of the good grain into the fines, which are the smaller ones, but we wanted more fines than we were getting money for the fines. So we would do that at the cost of the good grain. We try and get as much many as much fines out as we could.
So blending, I think it's sometimes called.
Well, no,
So
but
they're
this wasn't
blending
blending.
various.
This was a specific product
Okay.
that we were creating or getting out of the grain. Normally, what you're doing is your specific product would be the main seed, the canola seed, rapeseed, whatever you want to call it, itself. In this instance, in the one particular case I'm talking about, it was what normally would be called refuse. That's what we were getting out of it. So we were getting as much of the small stuff out as we could. That was the product. We lose more of the good stuff into the small stuff and not worry about it because we were selling actually the small stuff. So we would go up to our tolerances on the big stuff and the small stuff. But that was all created, that was all had nothing to do with the CGC. That had to do with the end use customer and what they would do. They would create. So we would create the product that they wanted. And so it made it really interesting. And more of that happened over the years with all grains, with wheats and everything else. But that was all in conjunction with the CGC as well. CGC would call something, for example, a two red, but we didn't care whether it was a two red. It made no difference to us because what we were doing was blending different varieties with maybe different milling characteristics that had nothing to do with the grade of the grain. So as long as we did that, we would blend three or four different varieties. In one particular case, that would go over to make the bread for the English royal family, to Warburton Bakeries. And again, it made it interesting. So when you were shipping over from these large elevators, you had to have specific tonnages of certain varieties of various wheats. So it wasn't just a matter of going down and opening bins and running to the vessel. You had to do it. In the old days with the blending, certainly in our plant, the regular employees were very, very involved in the blending in conjunction with the inspector. And we did a lot of the control from the tunnels ourselves in conjunction with the inspector. And
to keep it within tolerances.
Yeah, but we did our own opening and everything else. Later on, when they were just throwing people into the tunnels, they were just throwing people in who knew how to open bins. That's it. They didn't know how to open bins, you know, so and so much to get so and so many tons per hour into that system. So they really lost the dropped the ball on training there, because they lost a real resource. And in the blending market, but a lot later on, the blending didn't really mean that much anymore.
The so many questions come up just as a result of all this good information that you're giving us. I'd like to talk a bit about culture of the various elevators. So comments here about actual cultural differences. So when you started, were there still, you know, was there still a lot of non or not very proficient English speaking people? Did the elevator, the UGGG in Current River versus UGG McCabe, did they have in themselves different cultures?
Yeah, McCabe's and Elevator A definitely had different cultures. They came from different companies, right? Some of those people at McCabe's came from Thunder Bay Elevator, and some of them were also original McCabe's employees. And a whole different way of working than the house in Current River.
So say a bit more about what causes you to say that. What were some of the situations that made you realize there was a different culture?
One thing, McCabe's was a Bobcat house, and a whole different way of receiving. And so you had, how many was there, five receivers? Four or five receivers, but on each track you had, say, five hoppers. So you could go and dump all these cars and leave them sitting in the hopper, while the receiver, the actual receiving legs, they'd be directed to the various receiving legs. So the five hoppers on one track would all go up one receiver, say. So you'd dump five cars, and you couldn't do anything else until those five cars were all taken up, and they had to be taken up linearly. They couldn't be taken up in parallel. They had to be taken up in serial, so they were one after the other. So then they'd sit around and wait, and that's what you did, was you sat around and wait. They also came out of the old shovel house mentality, where you only did so many cars per day. So if it was 10 cars or 30 cars or whatever it ended up being, I remember at McCabe's, the goal went all the way up to 100 as technology improved and people work habits and everything else. But initially, I think when I started, it was only 10, and then it went to 30. So they were on a 4 to 12 shift. Most of the time, those people were at the Landmark Inn by 8:30 or 9 o'clock. Where us at A House, we went in to work our shift. We worked our shift, and maybe possibly overtime after that. There was none of this early quit, work like crazy, and then don't work at all. It was a steady, steady work all the time. So that was probably the major difference between McCabe's and Greenbrewer's, or A House. Is that the one was you reached a certain goal and then that's all you did. Whereas A House was just steady, you just kept working until the clock said you were off your shift.
Mm-hmm. The people who worked there, were they from different backgrounds?
Yeah, A House was all, it was just moving out of the Scots, and you mentioned earlier something that people with language difficulties. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, when I first started there and the Scots were there, I had far harder time understanding the Scotsman than I ever did any Italian that ever worked on the waterfront. Yet they had a prejudice against the Italians because they said they didn't speak. Well, they didn't speak Scot, but they spoke English clearly, and some of them didn't. and some of them couldn't read. Most of the Scots could read. And most of the Italians, I can't say most of the Italians, significant number of the Italians and Europeans didn't read in any way.
In English.
In English. They all could make themselves understood very well. Yelling was a lot of that. And they did very well making themselves understood. I mean, those Scotsmen used to speak down through a ship's tube. So you'd be up, they'd be upstairs talking through a metal tube like they do in the ships, going down to the bottom with your ears stuck to it. Who knows what was going to come down that tube other than the Scotsman's voice. But it did take us a while to get some of the Italians into positions where they could use the radio. And I remember one, Joe Frasta, coming to me and saying, Tom, he says, I'd like to apply. He was an excellent worker, very good at any job he did, but they didn't want him to apply for the posting because of his language issues. Well, as far as we're concerned, he had no language issues. He was as clear as anybody, but there's a prejudice there, right? So anyway, he applied for the posting and got it and remained in that position very successfully until he left the elevator.
Now, you mentioned Italian. Was it because A House mainly had Italians, or were there other non-English?
Well, we used to say the main hiring hall for the A House was the Italian Hall.
Okay.
So the previous superintendent drank there, and he would hire people right out of there. And then there's the connections, family connections, and they're, number one, they're small, they're good workers, mostly small and good workers.
What does small have to do with it?
Because the elevators weren't designed for 6 foot people. They were designed for people to get into small places, do work. Like they went to Sammy and Shorty at McCabe's, they had to go down. In those days, they would be kept overtime, they'd go down into the sunken receiver pits, receiver leg pits, which were something like 8 feet deep. And you wouldn't clean those things out. I've done that many times and things like that, and I'm not small. But running around in the basement and that was much easier for small people. If you've seen the designs, and I know you have, they aren't made for tall people. They're made for short people. Women would be another thing, but unfortunately there aren't very many hired.
And if we switch over to McCabe's, you said some came over from Thunder Bay Elevator.
Yeah.
And what was the ethnic makeup there?
Seemed to me it was more of the Polish, just as I was starting, it was more like the Polish and European, but not Scots and English. You notice I don't say Irish.
No Irish?
Very few, yeah. But the, I'd say more European.
Czechoslovakian,
yeah.
Polish, Ukrainian.
Ukrainian, yeah. And of course we had them in our plant as well. A lot of the Balkan states.
Mm-hmm.
No Asians, no Native Americans, or one or two maybe. No coloreds of any kind, no women.
In spite of possible language differences, would you say that most of the time people worked very well together, got the job done?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are always certain people who just don't work. That's in a big operation. In those days, it was a big operation where you had 235 people at Grain Growers. I believe that was just at Grain Growers with three chefs. And there were some jobs that there were three and four people doing that job. So you're doing only a small part of the job, then your job is done and you go down the line. So there's always people to cover. So you always have certain people who don't work. You know, they're well known and that's the way it is. But over the years, very few of them survived because you lost people. You had to have people who learned to work. You know, and everyone did learn to work. And it worked well together. I didn't see any issues of, you know, people sometimes would denigrate the Italians, more specifically, or hunkies, but, and not to any serious extent, that not in my career anyway. I mean, mm-hmm. we worked very well together, all of us.
You'd started to talk about the difference in operation between A House and what became M House. And you were talking about the grain receiving. What other differences were there between those two elevators that were notable?
Well, you couldn't do things as fast as McCabe's. For a number of reasons, it's designed. I mean, it was an L-shaped design, so everything that came in, it couldn't just go up into the annex. It had to go up onto the bin floor, onto these cross belts, and then so you had to make these various turns. Same as coming out of the tunnels, you had belts were coming perpendicular to each other. So you're not feeding in line, you're feeding perpendicular to each other, which loading onto the belt at that point is problematic. So you don't have the... you had to be very careful when you're shipping not to of course, overload. And secondly, that your grain was distributed. It was critical that your grain was distributed so you weren't stuck on what we call the short belts. Short belts generally loaded perpendicularly. And if you had a long string of stuff from the car shed, you wanted to make sure you were still pretty well. You were trying to make sure there was space, one receiver going on one belt in the annex, not five belt. As soon as you went to five belt, you had to go through the drag later, and then they actually had a trip that would move back and forth on a perpendicular conveyor. Very, very awkward. That's the way it was designed.
Mm-hmm.
So that slowed everything down, and in shipping, it was all straight from the scale, high spout shipping. So there's two high spouts, so the ships had to move back and forth to load, where A House, we could ship from anywhere in the elevator, including using receivers, right off the receivers. And just before I got there, and maybe the first couple of years, we could also ship right from the cleaners. But so could McCabe's. So those things are, we would just move various slides and do that. So that flexibility canceled each other out. But I mean, we could, any grain in our plant at A House could be shipped to any hold on any boat without shifting the vessel.
And that was a feature of the inline elevators, like the one where the workhouse is in the center?
Well, some of the inline elevators are still high spout elevators.
Hmm.
And Viterra still uses high spouts on theirs. Ours had a gallery. So pool one had a gallery and we had a gallery. And the gallery allows you to move the grain conveyor or trips, grain trippers on grain conveyors to various different shipping bins. So any shipper, if there's four shippers can access any one of the shipping bins that goes from the bow of the ship to the stern. And so huge flexibility,
mm-hmm.
where four shipper at McCabe's could only go on two high, and two high is set physically in the wall. It only moves this way and that way, and it couldn't hit if the bow of the ship was up there. Nothing from four shipper could go to the stern until you move the vessel.
Mm-hmm. So were there any aspect of McCabe government elevator? Was there any aspect of that elevator that was an advantage?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could, with the cleaners, when I worked there, when it was full, the cleaners were full running and the jugglers were working properly and the various slides were working properly, you could dump and clean out of that place through that cleaner deck very, very efficiently. And even some of the shipping aspects, because you could throw you'd be cleaning like two or three sections, you could throw that right onto a shipper and right onto the boat. So I thought the cleaner deck really worked well. But our place used to have some of that stuff, but it was all removed pretty well when I got there. I didn't see all the flexibility we originally had. But McCabe's, plus it was a very enjoyable place to work at McCabe's.
Why is that?
It was small, and at the end, We had a small crew working there. And when for so many years you're trying to make sure that the plant is going to exist, you really get into a team atmosphere working here with management and the people who work there. And there were some of us who became more like specialists at McCabe's and part of a crew, and there were people they'd call to go over there when things needed to be done. So there was quite a bit of pride taken in running that little operation. And at one time, actually, I wish we could find the plans. They were looking at three-sided loading in that place. In the end, the pool one side, and the where the tugs were over at the Thunder Bay side. There was a huge plan in how that whole property was going to be developed. Wonderful plan. And McCabe's at that point would have been one of the major, if not the major, plant in Thunder Bay. Never happened, of course. It stayed as it was. Lots of structural problems in McCabe's.
Such as?
I don't know. Is it condemned now?
Not that I'm aware of.
Like, we, in the 90s, when we were cleaning bins, we would, first I would go down underneath and sweep off the flooring and check for cracks in the actual flooring from underneath. And then up top, when we set up our equipment, we set it up on planks. So you'd spread the load over 8 feet instead of 2 feet because there was structural problems with the floor. We had the engineers coming in and gauging the cracks in the wall on the shipping side regularly. So I remember going down a bin with a Magicube flash camera, taking pictures of the cracks. Of course, it doesn't work, right? But you can't tell the engineers that. So, in fact, Jack Malcolm, who you may or may not know, John Malcolm, he ended up being the mechanical superintendent at Greengrocers. I don't know if you interviewed him.
Mm-mm.
But he, good guy to interview. The engineers wanted to go down and look at the cracks, but they became terrified when they looked down the bin and saw what they were getting into, whether it was fear of heights or dust or whatever it might be. So I went down and they sent me this Magicube camera to go down and with the flash working. Well, you know, flash doesn't dust, even a little bit of dust in a flash. But anyway, so there wasn't that much dust. And so the engineers are up on top of the, looking, we had one of those big old Ferrano chairs, so they're leaning out, looking down, and I'm straight down below, and Jack Malcolm's standing with them. And I didn't know, of course, but what he was telling them was that, wait, as soon as Tom presses that button and the flash goes off, stand back. And the guy says, why? And he says, well, that flash can ignite all that dust, and he's going to come flying up out of that bin. And they jumped back. They wouldn't go anywhere near that hole on there. We knew it was all a joke. It would never work, you know. You know, and we wouldn't have been going down there doing that if we didn't. Like I say, but the engineers are clueless as far as that goes.
So those bins then, dangerous when full, but empty, probably would stand for a long time.
I've always wondered about that, because when they're full, there's more stability given to the grain. So, I mean, the whole building, if it's full, I mean, is that pressure and weight something that's more dangerous, or does it actually stabilize the all the empty spaces so the plant's actually more stable? Mm. I don't know.
Yeah.
An engineer would know.
So when it came time to decommission the elevators, when we had the implosion of the elevators, all of the mergers, then it was a pretty easy decision, would you say, to close down UGGM?
Well, at that time, there was another factor come in, as we bought Pool One. The company I worked for became Agricore United, so merging was called a merger. It was a rule to be a purchase, but it was a merger of Manitoba Pool and the former Alberta Pool and United Grain Growers, and that became well, actually, Manitoba Pool and Alberta Pool had become AgriCorps, and we were United Grain Growers, and so we merged with AgriCorps. So we acquired Pool 1 over by, you know, where Pool 1 is, which is a very good elevator.
Next door to?
P&H.
Parrish and Heinbecker.
Yeah.
So.
So at that point, having Pool 1, it was an easy decision to decommission McCabe's. I don't think it was taken very lightly because there was a soft spot in lots of people's in management and including management in Winnipeg heart for that place and that property and the potential of that property. And you've heard yourself probably in the intervening years some thoughts about someone buying Pool 1 and using that for storage but shipping almost like Pool 4 was connected, shipping across to some type of facility on that property at McCabe's. And remember, I think the Harbor Commission Port Authority had talked about something like that, and whether they were going to put biofuel type stuff in there, whatever it was. But I mean, it was use of that property was, and I guess it still is, because it's still all owned by the Port Authority, right? They've never sold it. So the potential is still there. Anyway, so that did make it easier to close them because you had Pool 1.
So how would, what were the features of Pool 1?
Well, higher capacity, faster dumping and shipping all the way through not the old part of it, the part that's closer to town, but all the outshore part of it had all been redone. A lot of the equipment was brand new. Manitoba Pool did a really good job of keeping their elevators clean and well-maintained, which had gotten worse around some of the other plants, certainly plants I worked in. So Manitoba Pool 1 was more, was probably one of the best on the waterfront at that time. I mean, it couldn't match pure production with us or Pool 7, but it could run a long time without needing a lot of repairs to it. Like Pool 7 is basically falling apart. I mean, they're always working on that. They've been doing contractor crews in there since the early 90s. They never stop. But the Pool 1, you could actually run it and neglect it for a while and have a good place. And it takes less people to run. It takes like 15 people to run it. So.
Now, a couple of things from those comments. You'd said it was Manitoba Pool ran a clean shop.
Yeah.
UGG, where would it fit? Like from your experience in various elevators, which ones?
It went way downhill as far as even with the maintenance, preventative maintenance and stuff like that, because wherever they could cut non-production costs, they did. So the maintenance went way downhill, the cleaning went way downhill. We were always after them to do something, and in some years they did. In the 2000s even, we did major projects. But not to the same extent as Pool 1. Like dealing with fungus over at Pool 1, they did a whole, whatever they used in it, made sure it was all gotten rid of, and things were handled very well. But then again, when we're sitting in another plant, the tendency was always that the grass was greener on the other side too, eh? Unless you knew different.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd worked in Pool 1, so I knew what it was like.
So if you were to give out good housekeeping awards across the waterfront,
yeah.
Who would...
Richardson's and Pool 1, for sure. And not counting Gandamalt. Gandamalt is a different story, but...
In what way?
Well, because of the malting plant, there's different requirements. All of us ended up being food grade under HACCP. So
HACCP?
HAACP, I think it is. It's a set of standards, like ISO standards. But all of our plants, including like all of our grease, became food. You can eat the grease in a plant. It's food grade grease. It's so United Grain Growers A House came under that standard. Viterra came under that standard. All of the plants did. Anything that was going into a food line. So, and also in conjunction, of course, with CFIA, everything was checked, and a lot of the stuff they used to do, like people used to go to the bathroom on the belts and things like that, garbage was on the belts, and
they used to go to bathroom on the belts
regularly because you couldn't leave, and there's no bathroom. There's only one bathroom in the whole plant. It's, you know how big it is, so you had to go to the bathroom on the belts.
And when, where would your
into your Cheerios? But years ago, those all became. I remember our superintendent when we were cleaning in 2001. I remember that because it was the September 11th. And he said this is an elevator, not a hospital, but he was proven wrong. Because we end up coming up to a cleaning grade where it's as if you were serving in a restaurant, almost. Very clean.
Yeah, and, you know, did that really require a whole lot of change? I mean, other than some obvious ones that you'd like to see change.
Oh, yeah, they had to get away from the culture of doing that. Remember, there was smoking then, too, so cigarette butts would go on and things like that. There was garbage, food garbage. But you'd see things going on. I've seen a cat go onto a ship when we were loading a ship. Dead animals, all kinds of things.
Wouldn't they be picked up in... Well, the scales, or
no, they can go right through. The cat that I saw went into number two hold on a particular shift to the sixth shipping bin. We stopped loading right away. That cat was alive, and it either had either got upstairs somehow and jumped onto the belt after, or it had survived coming up the leg, and it was pranced on the belt, or perched on the belt, looking at me as it went into the tripper and down into sixth bin. So I shut it off right away, shut off the grain, and. And by the time they got the bin closed on the vessel, the shipping bin closed, John Matajek was on looking for it. They were looking all over that hole. They couldn't find it. And then we went in the bin after and checked, and we couldn't find it anywhere at all, that cat. So it got buried in the grain in the hold. But it was alive when it was on that belt. It was looking right at me, just like my pet at home.
Monica, can we have a pause? Okay.
Okay, ready?
Yeah. So, we sort of skipped over a story when we were talking about the language issue, and I remember you telling me before, so could you tell us the story? How innocent issues can sometimes escalate?
Yeah, I think about a friend of mine who'd started at Manitoba Pool. And he sent to the car shed, and he was working there with so-and-so person who was Italian heritage. And my friend is fairly rigid and I don't know if he's prejudiced or not, but he likes to be able to understand English. And anyway, this guy didn't speak English very much, so anyway... Close to 10 o'clock came along, and the Italian guy came up to him and says, "Go fuck off." And my friend said, "What did you say?" He says, "I tell you, go fuck off." And my friend said, "If you say that one more time to me, tell me to do that, I'm going to plow you one." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Go fuck off." So the guy plowed him. And the thing was, of course, he thought the guy was saying, "Go fuck off." But the Italians, when they say that, they say, "Go fuck off." So that was true, and he did plow.
And did he go for coffee?
And he learned when he went for coffee that was one of the issues he was going to have to learn to understand broken Sicilian.
And what did the... I mean, if I were the Italian guy, I'd be really annoyed.
Oh, he was upset, and they all had to go in and see the Malin, who you interviewed, Maria Malin, and they straightened it all out. And so there were lots of other physical incidents that happened over the years. One guy chased another guy down, not at Pool 1, at our place, all the way down Secord Street. Secord, or was it Cumberland? He was going home to Secord Street, and so he was having a tiff with one of his co-workers in a car shed, so he went right onto the sidewalk and literally chased him with his vehicle when the other guy was walking, trying to kill him or injure him as badly as he could. And the other guy dove off and managed to escape. But they had a running feud. They went after each other with those long pike poles they used to clean out the hoppers I was telling you about earlier. And they were going after each other like lances, you know, going two together, you know, 20-foot poles and trying to run each other through. One was German, one was Italian.
Drinking involved or just animosity?
Sober. These people were sober, just straight animosity. That animosity existed every day at work between those two people. One of them worked on one track, the other one worked over in five, so they were separated. And most of the time you didn't intermingle there. Your track ran, all your work crew ran parallel with your track, so you were doing all your relieving there. Rarely did you go across to the other side. You had your area of responsibility, and that's where you stayed.
I've heard a couple of situations where people were actually sort of dangled over the edge of elevators or in
pits. Oh, yeah, we had a fellow who was hung out a window from the scale floor, because in those days all the windows opened, and we did our cooking and everything up there. And I can't remember why he owed money to the coffee fund or something like that. Anyway, they hung him right out the window above the car shed roof. So he would have had about a 50-foot, 60-foot at least drop from there, but he was pulled back in. And another fellow threw a black banana at one friend. So he was at one end of the scale floor, and his friend was in the middle of the scale floor. And as a joke, he threw it at him. Well, that friend ducked, and it hit one of the other people who were in the scale floor at that time, who happens to be one of the fellows who runs the fishing boats out here, Ronnie Giroux. And Ronnie's a big, strong character. Anyway, the rotten banana hit him full on. And as soon as my friend realized, of course, that he'd missed his friend and was going to hit Ronnie, he'd already headed out the door. Ronnie's big and fast. So he went out, and we had a fire pole on the scale floor. So as long as you hit the fire pole, you could slide, you know, how to slide down fire poles, so you were gone. So Al started sliding down the pole, and all of a sudden he came to a stop. Someone had him around the neck and grabbed his clothing, hauled him all the way back up the pole, and then he was taken inside and he was dangled over the side until many apologies had been made and things like that.
You had mentioned that there weren't very many women working at the elevators. That's sort of an understatement, right?
That's right. In the actual industry where I worked, there was none in our plants, either McCabe's or UGGA. Cargill had hired people right in, even in the 70s, they'd hired people.
So why some and not others?
I couldn't say at all. I know a number of women who are hired at Cargill, and whether they stayed or not, I know there are women there now. I don't think there are any at Richardson's. There's at least one at Viterra to this day. There may be another one there because I'm not up on the current hiring. But as of last year, there was only one, Leslie. At Richardson's, I don't think there's any.
Mm-hmm. There was an effort at some point?
Well, one time there was an order made that if you're doing any hiring, that you would need to hire Aboriginals, females, this and that. But that happened to be in the time when the elevators were all downsizing. So certainly South Sweetpool didn't do any hiring for years and years and years, as you probably know. They were more trying to get rid of people, not hire them. And a lot of the other places, of course, went down, and you're aware of the figures, going down from close to 2,000 people to under 200 people. So there wasn't many opportunities for hiring. And just trying to maintain the workplace and keep the people that you had as best as possible, getting people called back. So really there weren't that many opportunities. On the government end, of course, women and Aboriginals and Asians and everyone was hired. And so we had interaction with the females from the government end of things.
You have a unique perspective on this because you were working with the union, so you would see issues from that side, but also you were part of the workforce. So how were women received? The few that even on the government side, how are they received?
Well, I mean, even as late as in the early 2000s, there was a suit against the CGC and against United Grain Growers. Because, I mean, in a lot of places, what was plastered on all the walls and in lockers and everything else was pornographic photos. And she sued them both successfully and ended up getting a settlement out of both of them. Everything was basically taken off. And it's funny when they had were required to do harassment training and sensitivity training. When they did, it was very, very poor, but they did it. But it was neat when they did do it at Grain Growers. One of our guys, at least one, if not more, one that I know for sure, spoke up and said that he objected to all this stuff very, very much as well. And he wanted it removed from the personal lockers because he had to stand opening his locker and he would see things in there. So, I mean, the rule we always tried to have in place was if you wouldn't have it at home in your living room, you weren't going to have it in that workplace. And things were cleaned up, as far as I know, in most of the plants I've been in all of the plants. Any place I went, I never saw any of them, anything.
Did you feel that management was... pretty much recognized the time had come and were
compliant? They didn't recognize the time had come until a lawsuit came, until they were charged. That's the way it always is. It is with safety, it is with any of these type of issues. Until someone compels them to do it, they don't do it.
Were individuals charged or was the company charged?
CGC was, as the main employer, and the United Grain Growers was as the building that the main employer was housed in, mm-hmm. where the female people had to work throughout that plant. Mm-hmm. They said no, the female workers had no reason to be throughout the plant. Well, yeah, they did. Even to go up to load cars, to load boats, to do anything else at all, they had to go up. In one case, you had to go up to go to the washroom, you had to go up through the men's locker room, or the men's lunchroom, sorry, to get to the washroom that the women could use. So, obviously, there couldn't be anything in there either. And there was never supposed to be in the first place, whether it was females in there or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, early on, females were treated as, you know, sex objects and taken down to the boxcars and empty boxcars and fooled around with there by consent and whatever. There was all kinds of, that was all early, early days. You know, there was lots of females at the government end often weren't allowed to work in certain elevators where they may have had a husband or a boyfriend in there, or was suspected they might be. But if that was a blanket policy where they said, everybody, you cannot be working because you may be in conflict, that's fine. But unfortunately, with the CGC, it wasn't a evenly applied policy. It was dependent who you were seeing, whatever it was.
That you couldn't work at an elevator where...
Yeah, like Janice Tresh, for example, was going out with Barry Tresh. Barry was a foreman or superintendent at Richardson. Janice was a CGC employee.
So she shouldn't be working at...
So in her position, she definitely shouldn't have been working there because she was an inspector and Barry was one of the ones who was shipping. But in some cases, they'd say, no, you can work there and you know, it'll just be reasonable. Maybe we'll have somebody else sign off or whatever it is. In other cases, they just totally banned the people.
Mm. Would that usually, have been the
usually
same?
What would happen there is that they would ban the people. It would be more of a scheduling thing to have certain people in elevators that are at high overtime. Richardson's at high overtime, so favored people get to go into Richardson's for monetary reasons. So the original idea of the banning wasn't followed through on a consistent basis.
Banning meaning?
Banning the person from the plant if they were involved with someone who was in... the example I gave was with Janice and Barry. Mm-hmm. That's a good example because of Barry's position and Janice's position.
Mm-hmm. Would it have applied to if it was a brother, father, son? Or was it just a...
It should have, and again, it was a loosey-goosey policy about how they handled it. It would depend who the people were, who were in those positions. So, and in the old days, I mean, it was a joke that there was any type of arm's length anyway. I mean, the collusion was unbelievable. So, but that's
The
you.
collusion was
Well, you
unbelievable.
worked directly with the CGC. You colluded with the CGC in doing a number of things with vessels. So. And it would have to be done in a way so that the CGC wasn't, you know, caught at the end,
Compromised.
too, compromised at the end. So, I mean, it was done. If you're doing something like canola, and you can use a different sieve to get a different result on your well, for your dockage or whatever it is, then you can do that type of thing. And you can change your paperwork to see that, to show that. You just don't show that you've done it with a different sieve, but you can say that you shook it out. It's just not on an O28. You shook it out on something else.
And what was
So,
the advantage to cooperation slash collusion?
well, booze for one thing. Trunkfuls of booze would come into the CGC people at Christmas time and various celebrations and things like that. They'd be called down. We used to call it the shrimp. The shrimp would be arriving. So, like I said, I never saw any money change hands, but it was often booze. So it was favorite status. You always wanted to get an inspector who was known to be more flexible, which
And they
is.
all weren't.
Oh, some of them weren't flexible at all. Some of them didn't buy into this system at all. Some very good ones. Some people I know are working to this day, and they never bought into those systems. They were more of the young ones that are my age. What I'm talking about is more of the older generation. Going, you know, people who would have been fully adult and well into their career in the mid to late 70s. Most of those people were gone. The younger people, some of them followed in that tradition. But nowhere near to that extent. You know, now you might see at Christmas time there might be one bottle come in and given to the PI4 in there, or it might even be a coupon for a restaurant or something. That's not enough to make you change your, you know, that's something acceptable as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't make you change your.
Did when you came in, it would have been just as the old guard was actually starting to retire. Was there appreciable difference in any way, in anything, with the new workers versus the many of them
Are
were
you
the
talking
war
our
vets,
people, our workers?
the war vets versus
Well,
the newer got kids on the block.
we didn't have a lot of, because remember, we worked with a lot of the ethnic people. They weren't necessarily war vets. There were people who came in and worked in the forest industry in the 50s and the 60s. We had a few of the vets, but not many. Not many were, not like CGC. CGC, I mean, these people were hired back at the end of when, 1946, somewhere around then. So they would have been 30 years in by 76. And I think they kept
Heading
hiring those
out.
type of people right through the 50s, early 50s. And I can't say, but in our crew, there weren't a lot of, not in our elevator, there were more of the ethnic people. The people who came over in the 50s and the 60s. So the war vet thing wasn't really a factor with us. It was with the CGC, but not with, because it was that militaristic attitude in the CGC, much more so than in the elevators. In the elevators, it was more of a very cooperative place to work, even with the, you know, superintendents, much more personal in the elevators.
Was just to finish off the women situation, it was unfortunate that it had to go to a court case to have behavior more welcoming.
Well, mandated it. It was mandated
It
then
was
by the
mandated,
companies
yeah.
that this certain things, certain standards had to be upheld. Like Richardson's would have been a leader in that. When it was mandated, Viterra, I can't speak for Sasquatch, but Viterra, because I was there, their rules were very, very clear about all kinds of harassment, about all kinds of, whether to do with women or anything else. You know, the fooling around, male to male fooling around. Like, for example, I worked all winter with one of our millwrights, who never ever called the other millwright I worked with by his correct name or by a male name. He was Susie or Alice or whatever like that. And we did that for years. This is something else. But as soon as you moved to Viterra, they absolutely would not tolerate that, even though it was tolerated between the two of them. It didn't matter. That example couldn't be allowed to circulate around the land. They were very, very, very strict. Mm-hmm. To this day, they are.
Did you feel that women left because...
women left the CGC.
They didn't feel...
Absolutely. Women left the CGC early on in the early 80s, and even up into some of the very successful women left the CGC in the 90s or maybe early 2000s. I think early 2000s, who'd been there for years, who just couldn't be there, couldn't be in the Thunder Bay situation anymore. Some of them are still with CGC in a different place.
And why would that be?
Thunder Bay's attitude was very, really, really bad. Thunder Bay.
What do you mean Thunder Bay's attitude?
Thunder Bay, CGC Thunder Bay is very, very bad in all of the CGC across the country. You see that from the union issues that came up with the very, in Vancouver, Montreal, Winnipeg. It's not the same issues that come up in Thunder Bay.
So what would be some differences?
Well, their issues are more around work. Maybe hours of work, overtime, not treatment. Not treatment. Quebec is an entirely, you know, separate on its own. They didn't have the issues at all that we had in Thunder Bay.
Why not, would you
say? I don't know. I didn't work there. But I knew people who did work, went and worked there, and they very much enjoyed the atmosphere in the Quebec CGC. Hmm. Vancouver, again, another one. Whether there was a higher turnover and people left earlier, and or there was a new wave of management that came in took the CGC in a different direction. We never had new managers come in here.
So what were some of the grievances? Like, what would be the Thunder Bay grievances?
Hours of work, where to work, disrespect in the workplace, harassment in the workplace, or a number of harassment. In fact, what happens is that the first harassment grievances that came in were women against women. Mm. In fact, that's probably been the majority of them. Because what happens with the women is they come in and they take on the male personality. And they end up, to get somewhere, they become tougher than those males.
So the hours of work, the...
Oh, just general treatment in the workplace, work-life balance, general respect in comments and conversation, constant demeaning comments when women are talking or giving an opinion. As opposed to when the men are talk, there's a new word about it. You might have heard it. It's called mansplanation. Did you hear that on CBC?
No.
I don't know if it's a book about it, but I think the definition is when women are forced to listen to men go on and on, blah, 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 explaining it all to you, and it's always 90% of the time they know nothing about what they're talking about. And so it's called mansplanation. And there was lots of that in the CGC.
I think this is probably, since we're very close to 1 o'clock, this is probably a good breaking point. But we'll need to have you on the hot seat again, Tom.
Yes, well, at some point. It'll have to be later on because the now I'm getting into the busy time for the Blues Fest.
Right.
So there really isn't any time between now and July 9th.
Okay. So we'll sign off right now, and then we'll schedule something.